court. A is the construction of one word, the word limitations, found in section 33004E of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. 33004 is the section that was added as part of House Bill 4, the Tort Reform Actions of 2003, authorizing the designation of potentially of responsible third parties whose fault, negligence, could also be submitted to the jury. Section E provides that there is a 60-day reopening of limitations to join, or that limitations for 60 days will not bar the joining of these designated potentially responsible third parties. What does limitations mean?
Let me ask you this. Court of Appeals stated that section 16.008 doesn't matter if it's a statute of limitations or statute of repose, does it?
Yes. I wouldn't be here, but of course I do disagree with the Court of Appeals. I think the Court of Appeals missed the point. This court has explained on a couple occasions, and on every case who's looked at it has noted, a statute of repose and a statute of limitations are fundamentally different. This court, in the case from 2003, explained the purpose of repose to give absolute protection to certain parties from the burden of indefinite liability. In the case from the early 90s, the Trinity River Authority case, this court noted that the difference involved a substantive definition of rights rather than procedural limitation of rights. That is, an engineer, in this case, or an architect, or the other beneficiaries of statutes of repose, have a substantive right to be free from suit, which is fundamentally different from a statute of limitations. They have different purposes, they work differently, and lumping them all together may or may not make sense. Now, as the Court of Appeals did, Section 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is titled Limitations. And it includes statutes of limitations, it includes statutes of repose, and other administrative proceedings dealing with related issues.
The word
limitations can certainly be used broadly.
Court of Appeals also said there was no distinction with the legislature in those two terms. Is that also incorrect?
I think it would be safe to say that the use of the term limitations in that statute, in Chapter 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which was enacted at different times in different ways, means different things. The word repose, for example, is found in that section, in the 16.011, dealing with surveyors. The word is omitted from the statute, which is otherwise almost identical, dealing with architects and engineers. I don't think there's any basis for concluding that the legislature, in setting a 10-year statute of repose, intended something different between surveyors and between engineers and architects. But yes, so the word can be used broadly. The word limitations can be used broadly. Question is, it can be used narrowly, just a statute of limitations. You go to Black's Law Dictionary, you find statute of limitations is distinguished from a statute of repose. So it can be used narrowly, and it can be used broadly. And the question is, how was it used in Chapter 33, not how was it used in Chapter 16. And I think the Court of Appeals got it wrong. And I think I believe that for two reasons, or a couple of different basis. Number one is, of course, the legislative history of House Bill 4. That was a Tort Reform Act. It was, in many ways, intended to limit causes of action and to argue that it created what is perhaps a gaping hole in statutes of repose is probably not consistent with what they were trying to do in passing House Bill 4. If you look at the legislative history, the testimony, several times you will find a clear indication that the legislature was aware that limitations and repose are different. There's the testimony given by Senator Duncan, quoted in the briefs, about how limitations and repose are two different things and need to be treated differently and considered differently. So, which is a pretty indication that they used the word limitations with that background in mind. That is, they used it in the more narrow, limited sense, not to be redundant. The even more detailed was the testimony from Slack, who was offering a variety of amendments that quoted in respondent's brief, or attached in respondent's brief, partially quoted. And it points out, dealing with the situation we have here, the situation where a person might be designated as a responsible third party, but the cause of action against that person is barred.
So what's so wrong with having a 10-year absolute drop-dead limitation and then on the very last moment it's discovered, wait, there's another party, not granting an extra 60 days to add that party? What's so wrong with that?
Well, of course, that's a decision the legislature certainly could make. They certainly could create an exception.
Well, that seems to be the Court of Appeals holding.
It is. But it is inconsistent with the purposes of a statute of repose. A statute of repose says after this period of time, you aren't going to be bothered with it. After this period of time, you can throw away your records. You don't have to worry about this. You have a substantive right to be free of suit. And one of the things that I think the Court of Appeals missed is they say, well, it's just an extra 60 days, 10 years and 60 days. What's the big deal? And what they are overlooking is that if you sue a remodeler, somebody redid the roof leaks, you sue the new roofer who put the new roof on, he can designate the original architect, the original engineer, the original contractor who built that building 20, 40, 50 decades ago. It's not a 60-day expansion. It could be a decades-long expansion of the liability, of the exposure. It's not just 60 days. And that's exactly the reason you have statutes of repose. That's why this particular interpretation is problematical, because it allows these indefinite liability.
This is just a question that has no bearing on the outcome of the case, but what happened to Mr. Cox? Where is he in the proceedings? Is he dismissed? He resolved his issues?
I don't know whether the case against him was severed, settled, or what. I honestly can't tell you. I apologize.
No problem.
I wasn't involved at the trial court level. But you can see this indefinite expansion. There's one hallmark of construction litigation is that everybody gets sued, the architects, the engineers, the remodelers, the people, the owner, somebody responsible for maintenance. You could get one guy, one defendant within the period of limitations. If the petitioner's interpretation is right, everybody who has had anything to do with that property can be brought in despite the statute of repose. Product suppliers, even though their statute of repose is decades past, can be added. And I just don't think that is the purpose of the designation of third parties and the purpose of allowing limitations to be opened. You realize Chapter 33, of course, deals with torts. The typical limitations period in tort is 2 years, some torts are 1 year. Allowing people to be brought in after 2 or 3 years or 4 years is perhaps not a great hardship. If we're just dealing with an expansion of limitations, it's something on a significantly different order of magnitude than when we're dealing with statutes of repose, which are 10 or 12 or 15 years. And we're dealing with, obviously, long-term used entities, improvements to real property, buildings that can last 50, 100 years. So I think if you interpret the word, as petitioner would argue broadly, that it's to include repose, you have done serious damage. You've created a huge gaping hole in the statutes of repose.
When does the date begin on the statute of repose?
The date of substantial completion of the project, the building.
So if a home, is complete today, then you have 10 years to bring a claim against whomever may performed defectively. And you stated, but that would allow someone to bring in a contractor 24 years down the road. I don't understand that, your hypothetical.
Let me kitchen fire. There's a suit against the manufacturer of the stove there where the kitchen fire is. The stove says, no, it's not my fault. I'm going to designate as a third party, pursuant to 33004, the original designer of the house, the original builder of the house, the original architect and engineer who built this house 50 years ago. Under the petitioner's interpretation, that designation will allow the plaintiff 60 days to bring all those people in, and they have to come forward and defend. They have no witnesses, they have no documents, they have no memory, but they have to come in and defend that case. That's the loophole that is being urged, and that's the loophole that the Court of Appeals decided should be recognized in what otherwise has been put to bed. What the substantive right to be free from liability has this huge loophole.
How's that different from toxic tort exposure claims, where a manufacturer may have acquired a company and then they get sued because they're the successor to that company, and they have to go back and look at records 20, 30, 40 years ago and try to reconstruct some knowledge that may or may not be there, and courts allow those cases to go forward?
Absolutely. The legislature specifically addresses those sorts of things in Chapter 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and it lays out a scheme for dealing with these long-tail claims and when they don't show up and what happens. And obviously there's a balance there. You want wrongdoers to stand up for and pay what they owe, but on the other hand, I mean, that's an argument for never having a statute of limitations. You need to cut off old claims. You need to give some protection to somebody who did something a long time ago. It's a balance. And the legislature, in the case of toxic torts, I don't recall off the top of my head the section in Chapter 16, specifically deals with that and says, here's the balance. And they have, with respect to builders of buildings, said the balance is after 10 years, and unless you sent a letter with written notice, you can extend that to 12 years. That's where we're going to cut it off. Once a building is 10 or 12 years old, the original contractor, the original architect, and in my client's case, the original engineer, is protected. He is free from having to defend his work on that case. That's the balance that the legislature created when they passed the statute of repose, and to recognize an exception to that with respect to this designation of third parties, I think just takes away a huge portion of that protection, and I don't think it was the intent of the legislature to do that as part of tort reform. And this would apply to any statute of repose, the health care liability statute of repose. We've got a brief on that, an amicus brief. Products liability statutes of repose. If the logic of the Court of Appeals is accepted, these statutes of repose are going to be gone. Anytime you can get a plaintiff's lawyer who can come up with some defendant who will go then, for perhaps consideration, designate all these people whose claims are barred. And that's why I think the correct interpretation of this statute is simply to apply it literally. It uses the word limitation. Interpret it to mean statutes of limitation, just like it says.
Any questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Mr. Lorry will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. In the statutory scheme, limitations is a broad term. I'll put some examples in the brief. For example, the subject statute, section 16.008, which is commonly referred to as a statute of repose, is in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code under the chapter entitled Limitations. It's also in the subchapter entitled Limitations of Personal Actions. In addition, Section 16.008, as well as 16.009, which is commonly referred to as the statute of repose for contractors, uses the terms more than once that these statutes are 10-year limitation periods. And I think the courts, this court's latest writings on the statute of repose in Hollubeck versus Brandenburger, which is cited in petitioner's brief, it discussed another statute of repose, not this one, but in discussing that statute of repose, even this court indicated that it was an existing limitations period. So in the statutory scheme and also in this court's writings, limitations is broad enough to encompass repose. And so, I think so, that...
So you have, say, 2 years to bring suit against somebody for negligence, but if they happen to be an engineer, you have 10 years to bring a claim against that engineer, plus 60 days.
Well, you know, if your negligence claim against an engineer has got to be brought in 10 years, but if it's a latent defect that you don't discover for a period of time, like in this case, there is that 10-year period under Section 16.008 for engineers and architects. However, there's exceptions to that period, and I think that's what we're really talking about here. Does the legislature have authority to engraft exceptions on the initial termination period of the so-called statute of repose?
If in Justice Green's hypothetical it's not a latent defect, then...
Well, then if it's a negligent claim or DTPA claim, you're going to blow through the 2-year limitation period, but that's something that would be decided down below.
How does the 10-year limitations period work? If there's a 2-year limitations period also at work? I'm not sure I understand your answer to Justice Green's question.
In this case... there's a DTPA claim for a latent defect under Pachuca's home, which is a French drain that nobody knew about until right before the 10 years expired, when somebody got in there and tunneled underneath the house and found that the French drain that the engineer designed and inspected and certified the insulation wasn't done properly, was allowing substantial water penetration into the lower floor of the house. Nobody knew about it. So under the 2-year claim, you have the discovery rule applicable, but the 10-year claim is 10 years from the date he initially did the work, and that, you know...
But it's written just like a 10-year limitations period.
Yes, it is.
So if you... What if the statute said you got 2 years to sue for a car wreck, and the next statute said you got 4 years to sue for a car wreck? You'd have a direct conflict because one says 2 and one says 4.
No, because the underlying claim is subject to
just the... My hypothetical. One statute says you got 2 years to file a car wreck, and the other says you got 4. Those are conflict.
No, the 2-year has the discovery rules applicable because it conceivably...
I didn't put anything about discovery rule in there. I said if one statute says you got 2 years to file suit and one says 4, you've got a conflict.
Potentially, yes.
Now, the statute, neither statute says anything about discovery rule. Negligence, there's no negligence statute that says anything about discovery rule. That's a court interpretation. So now you're saying there's a statute that says 2 years and a statute that says 10. And that seems to create a conflict.
Potentially, the DTPA has a written a
right.
discovery rule into
negligence
it.
Negligence doesn't.
That's correct.
We did that.
Yes.
And so you're saying the two conflict.
Not in operation. In your hypothetical, they do, but when you apply the discovery rule, they don't.
Why can't there be a discovery rule to a 10-year limitations period, too?
I don't think the legislature has engrafted a discovery rule, but
they
have
with
engrafted
negligence
it.
Either.
Excuse me?
But they didn't with negligence either.
They haven't grafted exceptions to the cutoff period on the commonly referred to statutes of repose. But in a negligence claim, that's a common law addition under the discovery rule.
I guess the what we're probing is, if you're saying that limitations means limitations, whether it's this statute, 16.008, or the negligence statute, and you should treat them similarly, not as totally separate animals, don't we get into some problems?
Potentially. There are similarities, and a lot of similarities, between statute of repose and statute of limitation, but there are also some differences. But I'd also like to point out, Galbraith's proposed ruling that limitations just means traditional statute of limitations, not statute of repose, creates problems. And it's also inconsistent with the statutory scheme the legislature adopted concerning limitations, and I'll give some examples. The first one, and it's in the handout that I filed yesterday, is Civil Practice and Remedy Code Section 16.069, counterclaim and cross-claim, which allows a defendant to counterclaim and cross-claim when it's been sued, if the claim arises out of the same transaction and occurrence, even if limitations is expired, if they do so in 30 days. For example.
But is that a third party claim or just a cross claim or counterclaim?
That's a cross claim. But for example, in this case, if the Pachucas had known about Galbraith Engineering before the 10 years expired and they didn't, they could have sued both Cox, the builder, and Galbraith Engineering, the engineer. And if the answer date was after the 10-year period in the repose, under Galbraith's interpretation, Cox could not have cross-claimed against the engineer because limitation would mean the traditional statute of limitation, not the statute of repose, which had already expired. I don't think the legislature intended that result, and that would not be fair to the contractor and who might have a cross-claim against the engineer who did the allegedly faulty work. Here's another example.
But under that, under your scenario there, they could, everybody would be designated as responsible parties when you submit it to the jury.
Well, there would be no responsible parties because then both of them would have been sued, but the cross-claim would come after the period of repose expired. So that's not an issue on responsible third parties. That's parties already before the court. That's just an example where their interpretation would create an anomaly in that section on cross-claims and counterclaims.
But under your interpretation, if the Pachucas had waited 40 years, they sued, they would obviously barred by statute of repose.
Well, their underlying claim wouldn't be any good. Right. Because they still have the time to sue somebody.
But my point is 33004E doesn't say anything about the underlying claim having to be good.
Well, it's presumed because
it doesn't say anything about it.
It doesn't.
You're saying we need to read it just like it says, and the problem with that is you could wait 40 years, trump up a case with somebody, and say, look, I'm just suing you. I know I'm not going to be able to win. Name them as responsible third party so I can get my 60 days, and then it jumps back in.
Well, your underlying claim has to be good.
Where does it say that?
It doesn't say that. That's a potential. But you're giving the plaintiff's bar far too much credit. What's more likely, what's more likely to happen, the bigger risk of conclusion, according to their ruling, that you would not allow joinder after the statute of repose, but it would still allow designation, so the defendants would get an apportionment of liability. Mm-hmm. And the plaintiff could not recover. That is not fair. And there's a bigger risk of collusion because in contractors or builders, they often work with subs, architects, and engineers. If they could designate, those people have no liability. They could testify to whatever they want, fall on the sword, and says the builder, who was timely sued, didn't do anything wrong. And there's a much greater risk of collusion in that respect for parties who normally and customarily work together than in the your scenario, Your Honor. And that's one of the problems that I was highlighting. In addition, when the legislature wanted to make it clear that certain limitation provisions did not apply to a situation, it specifically stated that in the statute. And a good example of that statute is Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 16.061, which has to do what limitation provisions are exempted from cause of action by the state. And it's in the handout. It specifically exempts numerous limitation provision because if the legislature had intended to exempt or not have certain limitation provisions apply to the proportionate responsibility statute 33.004E, it could have easily said so.
It could have easily said this, decided this either way. The problem is they didn't.
But if you look at the legislative history, they talked about it, and their Galbraith's proposed ruling would upset the legislative compromise.
I'm wondering about that. I mean, you've got a statute that says 10 years, no ifs, ands, or buts.
Well,
except for a notice.
There are some exceptions.
Except a notice with, you know, except a notice with within and 2 years thereafter. But basically, for for these favored kind of people, architects, engineers, interior designers, 10 years, and with a few exceptions, that's absolutely it. Then we've got a general statute that says for everybody, architects, non-architects, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, you're not barred by limitations, you name a third party. This looks like a general statute compared to one about architects. And if you got one, if we have one that says architects 10 years, that's it, never. And a general statute that says, well, responsible third parties, you get 60 days. If those would have to conflict and would have to go with the more specific statute, wouldn't we?
Not necessarily, because I think you're bringing up a question that involves the complaint of potential indefinite liability. And the legislature has the authority to make that exception. It has already done so in the limitations statutes. If you look at section 16.009, which is commonly referred to as the statute of repose concerning contractors, there is an exception already in there created by the legislature that could create indefinite liability, because if an action against a contractor is based on willful misrepresentation or fraudulent concealment in connection with the performance of the construction or repair, that 10-year period does not apply. So the legislature has already considered situations where there can be extended liability after the initial 10-year period, and Section 33.004E is just another exception that's going to apply in limited circumstances. It's not going to have universal application. It's only going to arise in very limited circumstances, like in this case where the latent defect was discovered right before the ending of the initial 10-year period. The builder was timely sued, but the third parties weren't designated until right afterwards. In addition, under the third-party practice and as part of the tort reform in 2003, I think this court may consider an amendment to the request for disclosures under Rule 194.2 and added L to require timely designation of responsible third parties. For all practical purposes, when this type of situation ends, the responsible third parties are going to be designated within typically a year after maybe the initial 10-year period, because in all litigation, all litigators in the state of Texas send out at the time of answer the request for disclosure if they're not included in their pleadings, and those are answered and the responsible third parties are designated early on, and they're brought in within usually the 11th year, maybe the 12th year at the most. And in the statute of what's called the statute of repose for the engineers and architects and contractors, there's already a 2-year extension in there. If you put them on notice before the 10-year period, you get an initial 2 years to claim.
I understand very well your argument about fairness, and I really hadn't thought about, you know, the collusion aspect or the possibility of that. But statutes of repose seem to have unfairness sort of sewn into them. I mean, you've got 10 years period, and that's how I've always thought about it anyway, that it seems to cut off a remedy of somebody that didn't even know one that there's a problem, that there's a defect. Discovery rule doesn't matter. It's 10 years period, and whatever unfairness that brings, legislature says that's our policy. So why? And if that's true, then the cleaner answer here is just to say 10 years is 10 years and there is no, you can't bring in a third party.
Period. Well, if that's what the court decides to do, and that may be the court's direction, I don't know, but there is an issue of fairness there. If you're going to cut off the joinder after 10 years and make it absolute and not recognize a statutory exception, then you should not allow the designation. And that would have been easily done. And in the handout, I show you, the legislature could have put in CPRC in Section 33.004. They could have put in limiting language. Or even better, in the applicability section and under the proportionate responsibility statute 33.002, they could have added a sentence, this chapter does not apply to claims barred by Section 16.008 and the rest of the statute of repose. Now, that would be a fair result if that's this court's ultimate decision,
the whole idea behind responsible third parties.
Excuse me?
The whole idea behind designating responsible third party is to include somebody that the plaintiff can't sue.
Not necessarily.
Well, that's one of the main reasons behind it. It was true of employers. so that the defendant, who's a third party, can designate the employer, who the plaintiff can't sue because of workers' comp, but the defendant gets to cut the responsibility and argue to the jury it was all their fault. Same thing for defendants who can't be found, for criminals. The whole idea behind the reforms for responsible third party was to add people that the plaintiffs either hadn't or frequently couldn't sue. And you're saying that's not fair. And I said, well, that may well be, but
that's limited,
what intended to do.
That may be in limited situations, but the tort reform measures of 2003 were designed to allow defendants to bring in all responsible parties to apportion liability. And the legislature, when they were discussing this, decided in order to assure fairness that we may need to make sure the plaintiff can join, even if there's a limitations issue or a statute of repose issue, because it was discussed. So the legislature considered fairness, but Galbraith's proposed rule is designed to upset that legislative balance and that fairness. In addition, in the Code Construction Act, when the legislature is passing and enacting a statute, it's presumed that they intended a fair, just, and equitable result. So what Galbraith's proposed rule is not fair. It would allow the designation, but not the joinder. If the court's going to say you can't designate and accept their argument, you shouldn't allow the designation in order to ensure that the legislative compromise on fairness and that balance is maintained.
What are we to do with the 4 or 5 times that this court has referred to this statute as a statute of repose?
It's commonly referred to as statute of repose, but it's also a statute of limitations because they're similar. They're not separate and distinct entities. They're similar and related in a lot of ways. They cut off causes of action. The main distinction is the triggering event for the running. So they're similar, but there are some distinctions.
Your opposing counsel said that the surveyor 10-year statute of repose uses the word repose, 16.011, I think he said.
Yes.
Is that a different animal than the 10-year limitations and the provision at issue here?
It also has a 10-year limitations, but the statute in dispute does not use repose. That statute says it's independent of any other statute, but the one in dispute does not say that.
Yeah, right. So does repose in 16.011 mean something different from limitations in 16.008?
I think they're the same. There's some differences, but they're essentially the same. They have different triggering events, but they do cut off substantive rights and cuts off causes of actions. There's many exceptions to those.
On your exceptions, you stated earlier that plaintiff will get an additional 2 years to the statute of repose?
Yes.
Where is that, and can you explain that quickly?
Yes, under section 16.008, which is the statute of repose, the 10-year limitation period for architects and engineers. In the statute, it says if you give notice within the 10-year period, then you have 2 years after that date of notice. So conceivably, you could give notice on the last day and get 2 more years, and the statute would then be 12 years.
So if you get 12 years, what I can anticipate your answer, but what's wrong with an additional 60 days to cure whatever problem the plaintiff may have had in this situation?
I think the legislature, within their powers, have that authority to do that additional 60 days. Yeah, that's in the proportionate responsibility statute. The same 12-year period is in the statute for contractors, which is section 16.009. The last point I'd like to make is that the legislature has right to make exceptions. They have made exceptions, some of them which could give extended liability that I've mentioned earlier. And I believe Galbraith is impermissibly asking this court to rewrite the statute, and the complaint should go to the legislature as on Exhibit 3, Item 3 in the exhibit. If the statute was worded this way, then we wouldn't be here today, but the statute is not worded this way, and those words are not in there, and those words need to be added by the legislature. So unless there's any more questions, I'm finished.
Just one question. Do you know what happened to Cox in this proceeding?
Yes, he was he's still involved. The litigation is still pending against Cox. It's abated pending on this outcome because the petitioner asked that gall breath be severed out so the summary judgment would no longer be interlocutory and would become final and can be taken up on appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I have reserved 5 minutes. I don't think I'm going to need that much unless there are questions I don't anticipate. There are a couple of things I want to address, respond to. One was the one that was touched on briefly with Justice Brister. He said, that is, respondent argued that it isn't fair to be able to designate somebody you can't sue. And as Justice Brister had one example, the employer, there are other examples, somebody who's bankrupt, had been discharged in bankruptcy. That isn't the statute. That isn't what it says. You can designate people that cannot be sued. That was, as you suggested, one of the principal reasons for that statute. So I don't think that our argument accurately portrays the thinking that went into House Bill 4, and it certainly doesn't accurately portray what it says. Another thing, the Chief Justice mentioned a concern over collusion. I think that may have come up with the Justice Brister as well. That is a problem. I heard that you shouldn't give the plaintiff's bar that much credit. Well, I actually have a case where that happened, and it's on its way to the Fourth Court of Appeals as we speak. You may get to hear about it later. I don't think there's been any collusion in this case. It is certainly possible for a plaintiff to go to a defendant and say, for consideration, I'm going to give you a big discount on your settlement if you'll designate these people for me. That was done in writing. And that writing is an exhibit to a case that may be on its way here. So that does happen. There is an incentive in 33004 for a defendant to designate third parties broadly, to shift liability onto anybody and everybody. But of course, that ultimate shifting doesn't happen until there is a jury trial with evidence. You can't just name somebody. You got to prove, if you go back to the statute, that they're responsible. So it's not just a matter of listing names. There was also a suggestion that if you construe the word limitations as used in 33004E, that interpretation will have an effect on all sorts of other statutes that use that word. And, of course, that's not what we're asking. As I pointed out, the word limitations is used sometimes more narrowly, sometimes more broadly, and you have to look at it in each particular case. The issue about cross-claims and counterclaims among parties already in the suit is not the statute that's subject to this appeal and is not the statute we're asking you to construe and is not something that we, is in any way involved. And if you could use the word narrowly here, it may or may not have any effect on any other particular statute.
Counsel, you've seen opposing counsel's handout.
I have.
And it says, indicates, italics show the language not currently in the subject statutes. You said limitations in this in one section means different things. The word limitations in one section of the practice
of Chapter 16 is different than other
different
sections.
It's different in different places. Why would the legislature not, if we read 33004, why would we not give the legislature benefit of the doubt here? It says not barred by limitations. And he says if they wanted to say except those claims barred by Section 1608, et cetera, they could do so.
Well,
and then under the applicability chapter, or 33002, he says this chapter does not apply to, and he says if they wanted to say claims barred by, and they could have easily done that. And so when we say limitations, your position is limitations means different things in different places. why would we not want to say if the legislature wanted to accept these things out, they could have done so, as he suggests?
You can argue that both ways. You could say if they had wanted
to... Let's hear your side of it.
Certainly. My side is if they had wanted to include that in 33004E, they would have said not only the bar of limitations, but also the statutes of repose. You got 60 days to bring them back in. You could have rewritten it to put that in there, too. You could have clarified this issue in that statute. You sure could have. You could have clarified it in their favor. You could have specifically clarified it in our favor. On the other hand, we're here to have the court help construe the statute.
And I see that. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted.